Welcome back. I'm Pierre Daly, Managing Editor at AdvisorAnalyst.com, and this is Insight is Capital. My special guest this episode is Elizabeth Kashner, Vice President and Director of Exchange-Traded Fund Research and Analytics at FactSet. Elizabeth, welcome. It's great to see you again and catch up with you.
Oh, Pierre, I was so excited when you reached out. It's a great day to be working together. Thank you so much for the invitation.
I'm really looking forward to our conversation. I mean, I think it's been kind of a, you know, we've been through this very strange period in markets. And I'm looking forward to hearing from you about, you know, what's going on in the ETF market.
For sure.
What trends are shaping things for investors and advisors alike for the industry. But first, for those of you who aren't familiar with Elizabeth, Elizabeth is Vice President and Director of Exchange Traded Fund Research and Analytics at FactSet. In this role, she develops tools and methodologies for all aspects of ETF and mutual fund classification and analysis with a focus on costs, risks, trading issues, and performance. Prior to this, she served as Director of Research at ETF.com and published extensively on the classification, efficacy, and persistence of strategic beta strategies and robo-advisor portfolio exposures. Elizabeth earned a BA from Brown University and an MS in financial analysis from the University of San Francisco. She is a CFA charterholder. Thank you for listening and stay tuned.
This is the Insight is Capital podcast.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast are those of the individual guests and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of AdvisorAnalyst.com or of our guests. This broadcast is meant to be for informational purposes only. Nothing discussed in this broadcast is intended to be considered as advice.
Elizabeth, great to have you on and really looking forward to our conversation. 2024 has so far been like a wonky year with investors driving up equity valuations, particularly in the Magnificent Seven or the Fab Six or Five or Four, whatever it is these days, while watching the bond market give back the 6 to 8 interest rate cuts it priced in December of 2023. When funds and fund flows are all over the place, or worse, undecided, as they have been year to date in many cases, given all of the uncertainty, what are you seeing in your research?
Pierre, I guess the first thing I would say is that, right now, 2024 is on pace to be a slow year overall for ETF flows. If we were on the same pace as last year, which itself was just kind of a moderate year, we would have expected about $270 billion year to date, but we're really only at $184. So that's significantly off pace. Like, lots of things could happen between now and the end of the year. So it feels like it's too soon to make any predictions on a full year basis, but definitely on a half year basis, it's a little pokey.
Yeah, there's a lot of holding off and wait and see. I mean, it kind of echoes what the Fed has been saying more recently. December was sort of watershed. I mean, there was this announcement at the end of November by, you know, Chair Powell that they anticipated 3 rate cuts and inflation, you know, was looking better and employment was still tight, but you know, they were looking forward to 24. And then the market got a little bit overexcited and priced in 6 plus, you know, 7, 8 cuts, got a little bit over its skis in terms of the excitement. And, so investors largely missed the pop in bond prices. And, you know, so look back on that and say, well, you know, that happened so quickly, I didn't have time to react to it. Although, you know, the markets didn't wait. And then of course, at the same time, equities popped, as well. So you've got this mix of activity and uncertainty. Some have called, you know, the activity in, the equity market, more of a risk aversion, like melt up, as opposed to a risk on, you know, vote for stocks. And so, I think lots of investors have also been late to the rally as well, because they just completely mistimed it. You know, things got completely surprised or shocked by the Fed's, you know, pivot in November. And now, of course, all that's been taken back. So you can see why, you know, maybe fund flows have been, you know, on a slower pace than they should have been, to your comment, right? Yeah.
Well, I mean, I don't know if there's a should have been, but certainly what we've grown accustomed to in the past couple of years. You know, there's also just the very simple explanation that if you receive a windfall or some cash income and it goes into your brokerage account and it sits in your settlement fund is yielding north of 5% per year,
right,
with zero risk, right? And so that's a very attractive alternative. It's kind of hard to beat that story at the moment.
I agree. I think what's made things weird is that stocks have run up while bond yields have backed up to, you know, 4.5, 4.6, 4.7 in the, especially like if you go in the longer durations in the 10 years and 30 years. But investors are still hesitant to weigh into the longer duration bonds. I mean, there's no need to at this point, but you know, it feels like like one of these markets where investors, you know, what do I do? And what if things turn? What if the stock run up, you know, turns into a correction? Or what if rates go higher and I'm in, you know, longer duration, or I'm in TLT or something, and it keeps on, you know, the yields keep backing up. And so, you know, there was such a confusion, I think is maybe the correct word.
I mean, I think you're describing the normal anxiety of the tactical asset allocator, right? Of somebody
right.
trying to position for the next month, 2 months, 3 months, 6 months, and is then forever anxious about, you know, getting it wrong or getting it not right enough or, you know, missing the biggest moment or not getting out soon enough, right? All of those, I think, are continual questions, right? We saw them really front and center when the meme stocks were on a tear and when thematic investing was all the rage. And, you know, my comment back at the time then was thematic ETFs are useful tools, but they're very difficult to time. Right? You need to really
right.
know when to get in and when to get out and have a plan. And I think most of the tactical positioning that you're discussing right now really, you know, falls in the same category. But one thing that I do think is different this year, and surely I'm not the first person to note it, is that because early in the year in January, we saw the SEC give the green light to launching spot Bitcoin ETFs.
Right.
You know, investors have had another, I wouldn't quite call it an asset class, but they've had another investment type to consider. And that is one of the striking things about this year's flows. If you look at it by market segment, you know, Bitcoin is number three. It's right there behind U.S. large cap right. and U.S. total market, and it's right above broad investment grade bonds. You know, I certainly hope that we don't have, you know, 5 to 10% of investor assets writ large going into Bitcoin. Rather, you know, the annual flows are one thing, and of course, there's been a lot of musical chairs in terms of money going out of Grayscale and into BlackRock and Fidelity and some of the other major
right.
providers. But that is definitely something that's new on our charts for the year. But the other thing that, you know, I just sort of glossed by what was in position one and two. Position one and two are the steady eddies. It's U.S. large cap and U.S. total market, right? It's
right.
like S&P 500 funds, Vanguard total stock market. Those are not tactical plays. Those are long-term strategic buy and hold, which has really been sort of the foundation of the ETF industry for the longest time. So, le plus ça change, le plus c'est même chose, no?
Like, right.
Like, the more it changes, the more it stays the same.
Right, right.
Pardon my French.
No, that was good. But I to your point, I think, you know, it's the activity in you know, new money, right, that has defined this year. And, you know, I think a lot of investors are opting for, you know, shorter term bond funds, you know, something with, you know, low duration and, you know, you're getting the yield for that. I mean, I think that's the interesting thing. I think that's the confusing thing at the same time, is that you have all these yield opportunities. Which one do you go for? Where do you place your funds to get the yield? Are you taking too much risk if you go too far out, or are you taking not enough risk if you go too short? And that's where, you know, that's been sort of a toss up between maybe investors, because of where we've backed up to in the yields, investors are laddering again and, you know, looking at their 60/40 portfolio and wondering, you know, what they can do tactically. And that's where number three comes in, which is this new kid on the block, the Bitcoin ETF, right? And so that sort of seems to be where the new activity has gone. And then, as you said, the steady strategic activity has remained the same.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
it's incremental funds is behavior of incremental flows is very interesting.
Yeah. And, you know, we're not really, aside from Bitcoin, we're not really seeing a ton of tactical movement at the very tops of the charts. Right. So large U.S. large cap number one, U.S. total market number two, Bitcoin number three, broad investment grade fixed income number four, U.S. mid cap number five, global fixed income number six. That's often like active managers, sort of a go anywhere mandate.
Right.
Broad-based U.S. corporate investment grades, number seven, U.S. large cap growth, number eight, intermediate U.S. treasuries, number nine, and last is, not last, but number 10 is developed ex-U.S. total market. Most of those are your classic portfolio building blocks, except for the Bitcoin.
Right.
There's nothing out there that's screaming tactical in a way that the thematics did a couple years back.
Yeah, very, very interesting. I mean, we saw, you know, in terms of our activity and content this year, that, you know, that sentiment again has echoed, which is wait and see.
Mm-hmm.
You know, pay attention to some macro, what's happening in fundamentals, what's happening in earnings. But above all, it's what's happening, you know, the market's watching the Fed, right?
Right. Well, so, and the yield curve, like when you look at the yield curve, you're not incentivized to go out any longer than 2 months, right? There's no maturity premium, you know? So why wouldn't you just buy a 2-month T-bill or just stick your money in a money market fund and go do something else?
Exactly. So, Elizabeth, what are the key trends in ETF investments that you saw in 2023?
Well, great question, and thank you for asking. You know, I think the first thing that we saw was a more normalization of the overall level of flows, you know, back to a healthy almost $600 billion. You know, continued interest in fixed income. But, you know, sometimes I think the information is more interesting when you do a deeper dive. And to me, the most fascinating phenomenon of 2023 was that we saw this real sort of parting of the ways between asset managers and investors, in that investors continued to gravitate to the very cheapest products, with, you know, continuing to push down overall expense ratios just by virtue of pouring more and more and more and more money into the cheapest alternatives wherever they can. But asset managers kind of pivoted and in some cases started raising expense ratios. And
right.
That to me was the most curious and perplexing thing that I saw in 2023.
Is it like, it's a tough business. Like I grew up in the time of the mutual fund boom, and the MERs on mutual funds, you know, going back 25 years, were, you know, by today's standards, astronomical, right? When you compare, you know, that mutual funds had MERs of, you know, well north of 2% here in Canada, and then compare that to an index fund, you know, that's almost free at 10 beeps.
Yep.
It's not, I mean, it's, there seems to be, obviously, I mean, for obvious reasons, you know, investors are gravitating to economical choices for their investments, because then they get to keep more and more of it, more of their returns.
Yes.
But seeing as the industry is, you know, having a hard time with maybe profitability on some fronts, making money as a business, is that part of the reason why some asset managers raised their MERs? I mean, it was to their detriment, right? I mean,
it absolutely was. Investors kind of weren't having it, but you know, I do not envy the asset managers their job. I think you're absolutely right that it's a much more difficult environment than it was when you and I were just coming up. You know, we are not aging at all, but the children, they're growing so nicely.
That's right.
That's how I look at it.
That's funny.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I think the rise of passive investing, the rise of enormous scale, and the participation, especially of Vanguard, where they position themselves as an at-cost organization, more of a mutual ownership structure that has allowed them to really have a laser focus on costs, it's put a lot of pressure on the industry. You're absolutely right. And so, you know, there's a couple of things at play here. There's go big, go niche, or go home, right? So that's what I'm hearing a lot in the asset management space is that there's definitely a line of thought out there that says you can charge a premium for performance or you can charge a premium for a unique product. I'm not convinced that either of those is actually true, but I also don't sit in a lot of asset management boardrooms when they make the decisions about fund fees one by one. There's also just this perennial trade-off between the assets that are currently sitting in your fund versus the assets that you want to attract. And so if you're happy with your asset levels and you think that your existing investors won't leave, whether it's out of fear of paying capital gains tax or just not wanting to bother or not even noticing some sort of inertia, you know, you might be able to ride that asset base for a long time and ride it at a higher cost, even at the, you know, the expense of potentially attracting some new investment. You know, that's one strategy that's out there. You know, there's still brand loyalty. There's still wining and dining your clients. But, you know, when number one, number two, and number three by assets are BlackRock, Vanguard, and State Street, and they're charging respectively 16 basis points, 5 basis points, and 12 basis points on an asset-weighted basis. You know, those are some big obstacles, right?
Yeah.
So that's
some very high barriers to entry, and then of course they're also on the receiving end of, you know, the Department of Labor's rulings for 401ks, right? I mean, that's that juggernaut of flows. Every month they're getting all these monthly, you know, defined contributions to, you know, to add to their asset base without really having to do anything other than continue to do what they do. And so where new entrants to the market come in is more on the discretionary side, or I mean, it's all discretionary ultimately, but the incremental, attracting incremental flows like new money, you know, somebody got a payout from their company or they sold a business or some new money has come in, where do they place it? And I think those specialty, you know, those explore items, you know, like thematics of the past, you know, where thematics had boomed, are they now being replaced by active strategies? I mean, are some of the big houses, the big issuers looking at getting into the active space, getting into sort of the all-in-one space where they're providing, you know, asset allocation type funds that are, you know, incorporating, you know, multi-strategy or multi-asset strategies, into one. Like there's stuff happening in the market that's interesting enough to, you know, collect a higher MER And as you said, you know, it's either really interesting or it's new or it's novel or it's active. I mean, active also commands higher MERs. Truly active strategies probably need to and should command higher MERs. But, you know, I'm looking at, like, for example, in the all-in-one category where you have 60-40, some 60-40 strategies blended with commodities or, mm-hmm. you know, these hybrid strategies that are designed to be sort of more all-weather like are commanding higher MERs as well, right?
Well, you know, there's what the asset managers charge and then there's what the investors do.
Right.
Right. And so you've mentioned so many different components of the market in your question. You talked, I think, a little bit about one and done funds, like a target date or a target risk kind of product, like you might find typically in your 401k. You've talked about model portfolios, which can be a more tailored or custom or just a unique blend of core and explore. You also talked about active management. And that's where I've done a good bit of research. So let me sort of give you a picture of the market, at least as it stood at the end of 2023. I took a look.
Elizabeth, sorry. Before you do that, I just wanted to ask you, because I'm quoting you, but you wrote recently that the average asset weighted expense ratio for the entire ETF ecosystem dropped to 0.172%.
Yeah.
Per year. That's, I mean, if you're launching a new ETF company, that just, you know, that seems, you know, impossible, right? So
it's not easy, right? And yeah. We've seen over the past couple of years, certainly since the passage of the ETF rule or 6C11, as we call it. Well, that's what it is called.
We've
seen both startups and old hands alike pile into the ETF industry. And I think despite the data out there regarding what fees are, we also see a lot of asset managers who are saying to themselves, ETFs are growing when almost every other wrapper is shrinking or maybe staying stable in size. So ETFs are clearly where I want to be. Now, how am I going to get there? Right. And there's a lot of optimism out there, and God bless the optimists. Where would we be without them? Right. We have so much less inventiveness. We wouldn't have much of a vibrant economy. And I would probably still be eating, boring Campbell's soup from the 1960s rather than just the amazing array of food products that I have in front of me. Right. So God bless the optimists, but sometimes the optimism might do with a little tempering in reality. And so this, I think, is just the perfect moment for me to talk about actively managed equity ETFs, right? Because we've seen the floodgates open between 6C11 and custom baskets. And the availability and then the sort of lack of investor interest in active non-transparent, we've really seen the market sort of settle into the active, fully transparent equity ETF. Over the course of 2023, there were 168 firms that were competing in the actively managed equity space amongst U.S. domiciled ETFs. I'm not talking about Canada today. Sorry, my friend.
No, it's fine.
of those, 4 firms held or attracted, I should say, 4 firms attracted 89% of the flows. The other 164 were fighting over 11%. Right.
So that's remarkable.
It's really remarkable. And I'm not done. Right.
Yeah.
So if you look at the 4, who were they? They were Dimensional, JP Morgan Chase, American Century, and Capital Group. They posted asset-weighted average expense ratios of 23 basis points for Dimensional, 34 for JP Morgan Chase, 25 for American Century, and 39 for Capital Group. And then the other guys, those 164 of them, on an asset weighted basis, they were coming in at 61 basis points, right? So you have the optimists, they're out there, they're launching, they're competing, they've got products, they've got stories, they've got sales staff, but they are also operating in a hugely competitive landscape. And so I find it totally unsurprising that the big four there are much more competitive on the cost front.
Yeah. I mean, and I mean, I suppose, I mean, it was easier for those four giants in the, you know, from the asset management business with their pre-existing fund business, mutual fund business, to come in and replicate some of their key strategies into ETFs, into ETF wrappers, even systematize them in some cases in order to get the costs lower, like shops like American Century and Capital Group, who are exceptional, you know, exceptional fund management companies. Of course, JP Morgan Chase. no, you know, that, that, that's,
yeah, they're old hands.
They already have the they already have the scale. So even if, you know, even if they were to lose money for many years after launching their newly formed, you know, their new ETFs, they'd probably be okay. But for the other 164, you know, that means that you have to be exceptional. You have to be doing something exceptional in order to collect those higher MERs. You have to be providing something extraordinary in order to stay in business, you know, to be sustainable, because of the high bar. There's such a high bar to entry in on the ETF side of the business. You can, it's, it almost makes me wonder, like, why not just, you know, if you have a strategy that demands a higher MER, why not, you know, just launch a mutual fund and go that route? But given what, you know, given your point that, that ETFs is where it's happening, you have to find a way to solve that problem or crack that nut, right? I mean, that is the difficulty that's facing these other 164 issuers. And out of the 164, how many are still functioning today?
Almost all. A handful dropped out. I can open up my spreadsheet and give you an exact count, but that makes for a boring podcast. So you know, most of them are sticking it out, but you do bring up a good point, which is about the overall rate of closures. And we have seen a real pickup in the number of closures and closures as a percent over the years. And to me, this is really, it's a healthy thing. And I think we should not bemoan the closures, because it's a good sign that we have rational players in the market. And when they see that something is not working, rather than keep at it for 5 or 10 or 20 years, you know, they're applying their energies elsewhere. So 2023 was a particularly high closure rate year. We saw about 8% of the number of funds that were open at the, you know, at the end of the prior year. We saw about 8% close over the course of the year. There's only two times in ETF history where that number has been higher. 2020, when we also had a whole bunch of ETNs closing for business, and that was a wacky year, of course, as you remember. And also 2008. I don't have to remind you about 2008, right?
No.
So you know, to me, I guess I disagree with you ever so slightly about the barriers to entry. I think the barriers to entry are quite low, especially after 6c11, but the barriers to success are quite high.
Yeah, and I think that's more along the lines of what I mean. It's not so much that you can't launch an ETF. It's how do you stay in business? How do you remain economical and be able to run a business if you're competing, you know, in such a challenging environment?
Yeah. But, you know, just to pick on Cap Group for a hot minute, like, you know, their ETFs are a real bright light in their overall business. If you look at a big picture at their asset levels, like they're still suffering outflows, right? Their mutual funds are losing right. money faster than their ETFs are taking it in. And so when you see evidence like that, you know, what you have to figure out how to do is to be profitable at a price point that, you know, will clear the market, right? So you have to just get much more efficient. You have to really figure out how to operate at scale. You have to do really well with your capital markets management, because that makes a big difference to investors too. You know, we're going to see more and more in the asset management space, people leveraging AI, right? Just investing right. in products and consultants and whatever it is that they can do to make themselves profitable at the level that actually clears the market, because the market has spoken.
Right. I can see a silver lining is that, you know, for those companies that are in the ETF and mutual fund space, that it will bring efficiency, more efficiency, as you said, not only to the ETF space that they're maybe newer entrants to, but to the existing mutual fund space that they're in, where they have to lower the fees on their mutual funds as well in order to compete, as you know, with as much equilibrium as possible.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that leads right into where we are now in regulatory issues, that we've seen at least a dozen firms file for permission to issue ETFs as a share class of the mutual fund, as, you know, Vanguard has done. Vanguard had a patent on that structure for, you know, two decades. And right. now that that patent has expired, lots and lots of players are looking for the SEC to grant approval to do exactly that. You know, Northern Trust was the newest one, just hit the wires this morning. But, you know, Northern Trust is now in line with lots and lots of its competitors. And if, you know, if any of those get granted, then, you know, from an investor point of view, there's definitely operational and tax efficiency to be had, where the right. sometimes, in the case of Vanguard, especially when they were just starting up in their ETF business, it was a trade-off, because the mutual fund lent economies of scale to the ETF, and the ETF lent tax efficiency to the mutual fund. So each of the structures had something to gain. That may or may not be true in some of the other asset managers that we're talking about. And of course, we'll see what the SEC says, you know, if they're willing to apply that permission to more actively managed products. You know, generally Vanguard has them on their very low turnover passive funds. You know, does the IRS have a say about having, you know, mutual fund taxes washed out by the ETF heartbeat trade? Like, there's a lot of questions that are out there. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a regulator. But I think just to bring that into the conversation and say, you know, not only can you learn from the ETF landscape how to operate your business in a more efficient manner, you might actually be able to borrow the very best features of the ETF and bring them into a mutual fund wrapper. You know, SEC yeah. watchers, you know, let me know when you hear something interesting, would you?
Yeah. So, Elizabeth, I know you started off by mentioning that ETF issuers, some of them raised their MERs.
Mm-hmm.
What were your findings on that? What was the reason they did that?
Well, you know, some of them was a result rather of inaction, not action. So the case that I dug into the most deeply was IWD and IWF. It's the iShares Russell 1000 Value and Growth ETFs. And, you know, you have to really go deep, deep, deep into the prospectus to understand how they actually set the fees on those ETFs. And it's a complicated formula where it's relative to the asset level in those ETFs, but also a set of ETFs that are not even in the Russell suite and maybe not even exclusively equity. There were some fixed income ones in there, but it had to do on a formulaic basis with what the asset level in that pool of ETFs was. And, you know, as it grew, the incremental charges would shrink. And as it shrunk, the incremental charges would rise. And, you know, because we saw markets contract so much in 2022 in both the equity right. and the fixed income space, you know, some of the thresholds that had been crossed on the way up with those products getting cheaper and cheaper, they were also crossed on the way down. And so that was, there was no, you know, fund board action for IWD or IWF that created a change. They were simply following the letter of their prospectus.
Right. So it was more of a logistical thing. It had nothing to do with deciding to raise fees and make more money. It had to do with just operational concerns.
It really was just like, well, this is how we do it. This is the formula. This has been the formula for decades. We're going to keep following the formula. Now, I did make an argument in my blog that hardly anybody digs in that deep to the prospectus, right? You know, I'm an ETF analyst. I look at the industry every day. I had never like actually gone through and done the math and ran the formula and said, oh, this is what's going on. In writing about it, I wanted to be absolutely sure I knew what I was talking about. So I did my homework there. But the average investor not only will not do that, the average investor will just look on the fund homepage and you know, to see a number that they'd been accustomed to see falling, to see it start to rise, it's not a good look, right?
Exactly. And they're not likely to do the analysis at all. All they see is that the price went up and
exactly.
Right.
Exactly. So, you know, and meanwhile, Vanguard has identical product in the market at a much lower price point. So, you know, that is definitely a case where if you're a BlackRock, you're most likely thinking about your existing asset base rather than, you know, growing it too much.
Right.
And just kind of hoping you can hang on, hoping you've got people who put that position on in the year 2000 or 2002 or something like that and are, you know, literally going to take it to their grave.
Yeah, because, I mean, if you bought it last year and then the fee went up, maybe under that circumstance, you might be tempted to switch to the lower fee equal. But if you've owned it for 10 years and you've had the capital appreciation from it, you're not likely, you know, the same way homeowners are not likely to move right now.
Exactly. Right? You know, I would put it a different way in that, you know, how many decades of fund ownership would you need in order to make up for the capital gains hit that you just took in selling, you know, so a difference of 8 or 10 basis points a year is not going to hold a candle to, you know, what is it going to be like 20% tax on maybe doubling or tripling your money? And then under current tax law, if you pass on and you leave a position to your heirs, the cost basis gets reset to whatever it was at the day of your passing. And so, you know, anything held in a taxable account where the investor has a hope of never paying taxes on it, they'll pay a higher fee to the grave.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's a different circumstance altogether. But, you know, how sensitive, I mean, I guess the industry itself has, because of the, you know, the mantra of low cost, are investors really like, they're very sensitive to the fees that are charged, but how sensitive are they? Like, is it kind of a self-fulfilling thing? Like, because the ETF industry is always talking about low fees, how big does the difference have to be between competing products for an investor to say, okay, my ETF went up by so many basis points, 10, 15 beeps. this past year in this. And then over here at Vanguard is the same product for substantially less. How much less?
So I think we can look at that by way of flows.
Right.
Right. And, you know, what we see is that I took the data back to 2016, and every year flows have gone to cheaper and cheaper and cheaper products, right? So the overall change in expense ratio, which has just gone down, 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 down every year, you know, most years, about half of that has been attributable to investor activity and the other half to asset managers. And the asset managers have been seeing what the investor preference is, and they've been, you know, competing to slice off basis points here and there. 2023 was really extraordinary for that not being the case. But, you know, when you look at the fee wars, if you dive into a very specific market segment, like, for example, investment grade corporates, short, intermediate, long, you know, you can watch the volley between Schwab and BlackRock and Vanguard, boom, boom, boom. I'm dropping a basis point. I'm dropping a basis point. I'm dropping a basis point. I'm dropping the basis points. And that's because they know what's happening in the flows, right? And then I think there's this one other piece of information that's important to put out there, which is that, you know, I think you're right that investors are willing to, in some cases, pay up for quality, which generally translates to performance. But it's just so exceptionally difficult to generate outperformance year after year and quarter after quarter. And, you know, the team over at S&P Global Indices, the research lab, they published SPIVA, right? S&P Active versus Passive Scorecard. And, you know, you'd be hard pressed to find a sub asset class in either the equity or the fixed income space where active produces, you know, long-term outperformance versus the index, and even harder pressed to find anything where there's any notable persistence, meaning this team that did it this quarter, well, surely they'll do it next quarter. Well,
right, right.
Except that's really not what the evidence shows, right? And so I think where you see the fee wars having had their greatest effect is on the largest products, which are also the broadest and simplest, right? It's the entire U.S. equity market. It's the entire ex-U.S. equity market. It's the entire U.S. investment grade bond market. Those are some huge funds, and they're, you know, you can have them for 3 basis points apiece. So, you know, Bank of New York has some products that are at 0 basis points. Like you can have a global market cap weighted portfolio and investment grade bonds essentially for free. Right. And so that's what is out there to beat.
Yeah, that makes it exceptionally challenging.
But it makes it a great time to be an investor. I had a young adult recently come to me and say, here are the options in my 401k. And there were a whole bunch of size and style type funds, like a mid-cap value and a small-cap growth. And, you know, here's a space exploration fund, and here's a real estate fund. And then here's our target date suite. And, you know, they're very simple. They've got a glide path. They've got 4 components, and they're 8 basis points apiece. And I said, young man, target date, the only question is, do you want one that's a little riskier or a little less risky? Like, you know, your birth year might indicate that you should buy one for, say, 2060. But if you want to take more risk, buy the 2070 product. Like, that's what you should be deciding here.
Yeah. Well, I think when you consider, you know, what a time it is to be an investor and all the options that are available at such low cost. It really does, you know, allow you to put the focus back on, you know, making the right asset allocation decisions and not be concerned so much about, you know, what you're paying for, who you're paying for. I can't help feeling like, you know, so much of the business is becoming commoditized, and, you know, that you really have, I mean, it's really easy today to build a core portfolio and then be able to, you know, maybe use the excess fee budget to explore things like alternatives, alternative strategies, to diversify, you know, that 60-40 traditional portfolio with, you know, a lot of these new options that are coming into the market. And, you know, and I think a lot of advisors are starting to think that way. They're starting to think in terms of, you know, fee alpha, tax alpha. They're starting to think in terms of, you know, rebalancing alpha. Mm-hmm. They're starting to think in terms of fee budgeting, you know, being able to, because I've got all these low cost core items over here for the bulk of my portfolio, I can maybe go, you know, I can feel more at ease about getting into that more expensive space, or more, you know, that active space where the MERs are higher because they're doing something special. And I think maybe that's where these other 164 entrants are looking competitively, which is like, you know, there is a demand for, you know, hedge fund replication. There is a demand for, you know, all-in-ones. There is a demand for asset allocation strategies that are, you know, structurally uncorrelated to the rest of my portfolio, or other return streams that cost more, like CTAs or commodity, you know, strategies that might end up in an ETF wrapper, and that do cost more money. The carry is a lot higher on you know, on those funds. The cost is higher on those funds, but mm-hmm. some of those new funds also have carry, right? Sorry, I got it mixed up. But some, like, for example, some CTAs, some of these esoteric, you know, more esoteric alternatives have, you know, like, some of our conversations have been informed by this, which is that, you know, on our podcast, which is that, you know, you can have your core portfolio, and then you can get some of these other alternative strategies that actually help you pay for the rest of your portfolio, because they add incrementally to your return.
Do they?
Right.
They might.
Yeah.
They might and they might not.
But assuming that the objectives are carried out and met.
Yeah. Well, I mean, certainly the intention is that, you know, that's the setup ex ante.
Yeah.
But, you know, it is very hard to find the diversifier that, you know, in the end really, like, you know, pays for itself. I'm a little salty because, you know, my father, when he passed, left my mom in good shape, God bless. But he also left her with a lot of complex private investments, and he was overweighted in corporate real estate, you know, and I'm watching my mom sort of like sitting with these portfolios that were supposed to wind up last year or the year before or this year, and they're extending and they've got more capital calls. And, like, you know, Dad thought he was doing great getting in with, you know, private hard to get managers, getting an asset class that he couldn't get in the public markets. And, you know, I think, of course, nobody expected what would happen with COVID and commercial real estate, but those IRRs aren't looking so great, you know?
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry to hear about the passing of your father.
Oh, gosh, it was 8 years ago already.
Okay, sorry. I mean,
he was a tidy man, but he left my mom with a mess financially. You know, investors are tired of paying country club dues only to go in and find that the hamburgers at the burger bar are, you know, overdone, like overcooked and cold, you know,
that's a great analogy.
Exactly. Right. I mean,
yeah.
And you don't get the best food at the country club because, like, it's exclusive. So you get what they serve. Right? Although they probably have to do like a really good gin and tonic. Else they'll lose members.
Yeah, they got to make up for it somehow.
I know, right? I know. It's Friday.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So, Elizabeth, what's the outlook for the ETF industry in light of these developments? What's your outlook for the industry in light of the developments you saw last year and, you know, for so far the, you know, what you've noticed this year?
So we're nearly halfway through this year, right? So,
yeah.
You know, my outlook for the industry as a whole continues to be really bullish. You know, we've seen inflows every single year since 1993. You know, we've seen larger and larger percents of the public funds space, of that money moving into ETFs and out of mutual funds. You know, so for the industry writ large, I think it's good times ahead, right? There's a lot of runway there, I would say. Definitely keeping my eye on two developments that we are really seeing in the retirement and the 529 space. We're seeing a lot more use of collective investment trusts, which are not public funds.
Right.
And they can often be even cheaper to run than an ETF because they have a different regulatory structure and they operate at massive scale. And so that's, I'm on the institutional side, I'm keeping an eye on that. And also interval funds, which are closed end funds that have sort of a get out of jail free redemption at NAV on a quarterly or semi-annual basis that solve some of the problems of closed end funds, but may also be allowed to hold much less liquid assets. So I think that is potentially an interesting structure out there. Does that mean that any firm entering the ETF business, you know, has a growth opportunity? I think our entire conversation has pointed the opposite way, that it's still a really tough business as an asset manager to make a buck. And for those who are thinking about entering, I would just really make sure you understand the market conditions.
Right.
So, and for the ETF investor, there are so many options. We're close to having 3,500 ETFs trading on U.S. exchanges. When I started in this business back in 2010, the number was 968.
Right.
Come to think of it, I think it was exactly 14 years ago. That's just it's an explosion of choice, and choice can be liberating. It can also be confusing, but if you put some time and effort and thought into it, you can build yourself an extraordinary portfolio that is broad and cheap and efficient and maybe has a little spice to it.
Yeah. I think as you said, and forgive me, I lost you, I think, at the moment when you said that this is a fantastic time to be an investor. Right.
I sure did.
Yeah. I would echo that sentiment that there's never been a better time to be an investor than right now.
I think that's really true. And one thing that is I think a constant in financial services is to always remember to sit in the seat of the investor and to try and speak with the voice of the investor. You never get in trouble, whether you're in the C-suite or the bar or a podcast like this, if you say, you know, I stand in the shoes of the investor and I think for the end investor. Like, you never get in trouble saying that, right? And there's a reason for that.
Right.
And that's because the investors are the lifeblood of the industry. They're who we are serving, right? And through market action, they're telling us where the service is good and where the service is not so good.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think if you know, there was a danger at times when investors could become disillusioned by the entire industry, by the market, whether it was during times of, you know, upheaval or times of, you know, controversy where, you know, scandals broke out.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think the early 2000s was like that, where investors really questioned what was going on in the marketplace. And then, you know, of course, after that, you know, all hell broke loose in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, investors have been through a lot, and they've become, I guess to answer the question I asked earlier, are investors really that sensitive? And the answer to that is absolutely,
right.
You know,
well, and I think you also asked in a roundabout way earlier, like, you know, in the world of the three basis point portfolio, what is the role of the advisor? And sometimes the best thing an advisor can do is to help provide that emotional and psychological stability, right? So that an investor doesn't become his or her own worst enemy. And, you know, I think that behavioral aspect is really notable, and there's a lot of work to be done in that regard.
Yeah, ETFs are extremely easy to trade.
Yes, sir.
And for that reason, it's, you know, a potential behavioral minefield where, you know, some investors might feel like these are so easy to trade. I can get in and get out. I can do whatever I want. I can move to whatever part of the market I want to whenever I want to. But as you said, it's not necessarily the best choice. You know, as investors who maybe exited the market in March of 2020 found out.
Yep, exactly.
You know, well,
that's why Jack Bogle was so opposed to them for so many years. He thought that
right.
It was, you know, too sharp a knife and people were just going to cut themselves.
Yeah. And I think it's, you know, because of advisors that investors are making proper use of these instruments for the most part. I think maybe that might not be true as much in the DIY market, but in the advised market, in the advisory space, you know, you'd have a hard time finding an advisor who would say okay to their client when their client's, you know, I want to get out of the market. I want to get out. I want to do this. I want to go there. I want to get into cash. Get me out. You know, the advisor says, that's not a good idea.
Can we think this through, please?
Yeah. If there's no intermediary, then, you know, panic feeds on itself. And, you know, investors do stupid things sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Without, you know, to your point, becoming their own worst enemies. Elizabeth, any final thoughts, any parting thoughts? What can investors do right now? What would you say to investors who are, you know, on how to navigate the market, how to navigate this space?
My advice is so boring, Pierre, because it's been the same thing for more than a decade. It's do your homework. You know, understand what it is that you want to buy, what else is out there competing in that space. You know, why do you want to buy the exact thing you want to buy? How does it work? You know, not just what's in the portfolio right now, but what can you expect in the portfolio in the future? So if it's a passive fund, learn about the index that it's tracking and, you know, how is it constructed? What are its rule sets? If it's an active, like, well, then you have to learn about the people and the process and all that. And that it's really very worth the time that you invest. ETFs are, from a user's point of view, a little bit more complicated than mutual funds. And so many people make the mistake that they say, like, well, I know all I need to know about this fund because I read what its name is and I saw the expense ratio. and so in that regard, I would advise people to invest a little bit more time. We are only talking about your life savings.
That's it, right?
Yep.
That's it? Is that all we're talking about here?
That's all we're talking about here, except, you know, at some point, my dog is going to have something to say, and it won't be about her life savings.
No. Elizabeth, thank you so much. It's great to catch up with you, and I hope we can do this again soon. And thank you so much for your incredibly valuable time and insight.
Well, thank you so much, Pierre. It's been a real pleasure. I always feel like I learn a lot from talking to you, and you're asking really interesting and insightful questions. And I appreciate that you're representing the investor, the advisor, the asset manager. You're wearing a lot of hats. So I hope you get to rest this weekend.
Thank you so much, Elizabeth.